The Tom Woods Show, episode 771.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, blogging, podcasting, self-publishing are things people do as a labor of love, but you can also monetize them. And I show you exactly how I've done that in my free ebook, Five Paths to an Online Income. Grab your copy at pathstoincome.com or text the word prosper to the number 44222. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Lots of nonsense out there. You notice that about the world? Lots of nonsense. We're going to smack some of it down today. In particular, some of these claims that income inequality makes people unhappy and unhealthy and whatever else. But it's not just that. There are all kinds of other things that people take for granted as being true that are clearly not true. And an expert at smacking down things people think are true but are not true is our guest today, Christopher Snowden, who comes to us from the UK, where he is a research fellow at the Institute of Economic Affairs. He is the author, most recently, of Selfishness, Greed, and Capitalism, Debunking Myths About the Free Market. Chris, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
All right, let's get chit-chatting about, I like this book, Selfishness, Greed, and Capitalism. But before I ask you about that, I guess I have to ask you the thing I think I ask everybody from the UK who's for the free market. Must be lonely work over there, according to what I hear from all your fellow free marketeers.
Yes, and it's particularly difficult when you write about most of the things I write about, because I particularly handle what we call the lifestyle economics, which is the vaping and the drinking and the smoking and the eating and gambling and so on, all the nanny state stuff. And the UK seems to pride itself as being something of a world leader in clamping down on people's private recreations. So it's quite dispiriting.
It's too bad, because I, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when I just would not have thought that that's where Britain would go. I just thought of Britain as a place where people enjoyed themselves. You know, I mean, honestly, I didn't think of it as a country like that. Isn't that the case? Like when you would think of British television and humor and whatever, you didn't think of them in the way that we think of the people who run the British government.
Yeah, but you'd kind of say that about New York as well, probably, in California and Australia and Ireland.
Yeah, I agree. And you'd be right. Yeah, you'd absolutely be right about all those places. Yeah.
There seems to be a thing about English-speaking countries, really. New Zealand, Australia, large parts of America, Ireland, and the UK are all the world leaders in lifestyle micromanagement, whereas people in continental Europe, particularly the further south you go, don't seem as interested in it for some reason. So I don't really have an explanation for why that is, but it's certainly true.
Well, I do want to talk about a part of your book that's not directly related to those types of themes, but it's related to something that comes up quite a bit in the American media, certainly, which is, okay, the issue of income and wealth inequality is just now destined apparently to be a perennial one. But in particular, we get these studies, so-called, these solemn studies that tell us that inequality is making us unhappy and we're dying earlier and there are all these related social problems that result from inequality. So in a way, it's almost like what they're doing with climate change. When climate change isn't enough to get everybody's attention, they have to say, well, climate change is causing all the hurricanes and the snowstorms. You know, now do I have your attention? So likewise, if there isn't that much purchase with the public that this idea of inequality seems to have, then we have to say, well, inequality is killing your family and whatever, then to try to get their attention. Tell us about some of the claims that have been made regarding health and other signs of social well-being connected with inequality. What's the truth of all this?
Well, there's a book called The Spirit Level that came out in 2009, and they really kickstarted this whole idea that inequality is not just unfair, and it's actually has detrimental effects, not just on the poor, but on the rich and the whole of society. And if you look at different societies and put a scatter plot together showing rates of homicide and life expectancy and infant mortality or even recycling, you'll see that the most equal countries do better and the least equal countries like UK and America do the worst. So this was trying to be an empirical justification for the left's suspicion and hatred of income and wealth inequality, income inequality specifically in the case of that book. And a few other people have made similar claims, but it was the two authors of The Spirit Level who really popularized it and indeed have provided most of the evidence over the years. And this stuff just doesn't stack up. You know, I read this book soon after it came out, and within a few chapters, it was clear to me that these graphs were not robust at all. There was lots of countries missing from them. They were using different data sets, different times and kind of giveaway things that that suggested they weren't playing fair. So I wrote a book called The Spirit Level Delusion as a riposte to that, in which I just redid the data. I tried to read their evidence, and none of it really stood up at all. But it's interesting that, as you say, inequality is a big deal. And I know that rates of inequality have been largely rising for a long time in America. They haven't been in Britain. They haven't risen in Britain really for 25 years. And yet it's been in the last 10 years, thanks to people like the Spirit Level authors and Thomas Piketty, the Pope, Obama, all these people saying inequality is one of the most serious problems of our time. And I guess they need to have a reason for that. These people clearly think that income inequality is unfair. Lots of other people would say it's totally fair, and actually total equality would be the most unfair system. And I think it comes down to intellectual impoverishment of the left. Because, of course, for most of history, people on the left, including Marxists, have been interested in productivity and economic growth, and the promise of socialism wasn't so much that it would make people equal, although that was one element of it. It was that we'd get richer, and the communist societies were going to outperform the capitalist societies and win the day. And, of course, that didn't happen. And now, having acknowledged that actually big government and centrally planned economies do not produce growth very, very well, they've fallen back on the one thing that these kind of societies do to some extent, which is make people more equal, albeit by leveling down. And so they've taken that one aspect of their political and economic program and made a great virtue of it. And by making a great virtue of it, have made a great evil of inequality itself.
What about some of their claims, though, that in more equal societies, people are happier, healthier, whatever the various metrics are?
Well, they just don't stack up. In fact, even the claim that people are happier in more equal countries is never explicitly made in The Spirit Level. And if you do look at the happiness scores, and you can be skeptical about these scores, as indeed I am, but if you do look at the happiness scores and correlate them with income inequality, there's no association whatsoever. There is an association with economic growth, as you might expect, but there isn't one with inequality. And on the life expectancy, I mean, anybody can put this data together quite easily. The life expectancy data and inequality data are available for all the countries you might want to look at, and it didn't really stack up in The Spirit Level. And if you look at the most recent data, it still doesn't stack up at all.
Your book also has some stuff on misconceptions that people have about economics, about economists, about the free market. And you in part one of your book, you have each section as a different straw man that we have to deal with. And of course, one of them is the typical capitalism relies on greed, because of course we know that people who run socialist societies have always been extremely selfless, and there was never any privilege shown to the state authorities in the Soviet Union, as we all know. But then you have a part, economists think GDP is all that matters. And I want to talk about that for a minute, because I wrote a book called The Church and the Market, dealing with, I really wasn't writing that book for left-wing Catholics, because I feel like I haven't got any prayer of changing their minds. It was the traditional Catholics. It was the people who would consider themselves right of center who had this criticism of the free market, that it makes people materialistic and fat, and all you care about is GDP, and aren't there higher values than that? How do you answer that kind of complaint?
Well, just ask for just one example from one person ever who said that GDP is all that matters. Nobody actually believes it, least of all free market economists. No world leaders believe in it. And going back right to Simon Kuznets when he developed the GDP measure, through to Robert Kennedy when he made his great speech about how GDP doesn't capture all the things that count in life, every few years a world leader will stand up and say that we need to look beyond GDP And GDP is not all that matters. No, on that, there is no disagreement. Nobody thinks that economic growth is a be-all and end-all. It does happen to be a very good thing. A lot of very good things do come out of economic growth and are correlated with economic growth. But free market economists aren't particularly interested in GDP per se. It happens to be an indicator of people getting richer, and that's a good thing. But the point about having a free economy is people can do what they want. It so happens most people want to improve their position, improve their living standards. But if people want to sit under a tree and read a book, then GDP can fall. I wouldn't have a problem with that, and I don't think many liberals would do.
And of course, if you do want to sit under a tree and read a book, you still need to feed yourself. And you can read a lot more these days because you can feed yourself a lot easier thanks to the market economy. So anything you want to do, whether it's materialistic so-called or spiritual, you can do a lot more of it when you have more leisure time because you live in a more productive society. That's what it boils down to. And I totally agree. It is such an irritating straw man. I just can't stop. I seems like I'm facing it all the time. How about the old, why not take it on, right? Myth number one right there in your book. Why not? Capitalism depends on greed. That one's a softball over the plate. What's wrong with that claim?
Well, it doesn't depend on it. It's just the great thing about capitalism, but by contrast to socialism, is that if people do happen to be greedy, you can harness that for good. And people, unless there's opportunities for cronyism, they have to at least pretend to be nice, and they have to at least do nice things and offer you a service that you want. If they want to fulfill their avaricious ambitions. So it's not that it depends on it at all. It's just that it acknowledges that people are at least self-interested. And that's really what these guys mean when they talk about greed. They're assuming that self-interest is greed, and of course it's not the same thing at all. But people are self-interested. It's just a fact. And any attempt to create a system which relies entirely on collectivism and altruism has failed enormously because of that one simple facet of human nature.
What about some of these other myths that relate to things like, I hear this a lot, we're working more and more all the time. And that's because, now you hear that in the US and people give us these stern lectures about how Americans have this perverse attachment to work and why don't they take more leisure time? All we do is work, work, work. And the only conclusion they can think of is, well, must be wicked capitalism must be playing a role here somewhere. So let's throw that into the picture. What's the real story about how many hours people are working in the Western world, or let's say in where you live?
UK, as in most countries, they've been falling gradually for a very, very long time. And yeah, again, I don't have a preference whether people want to work very hard or not. Obviously, some people do work very long hours. But on average, people are working fewer hours than they used to, and drastically fewer hours than they did in the 19th century. You know, that particular chapter is one of several chapters in the book where I just look at things which are just very, very easy to debunk. You know, this data is out there. And yet you have these pervasive myths. Another one is that the poor get poorer. You know, people keep saying and have been saying for the last 100 years, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. It's very easy to see from any source you care to check that the rich get richer, sure, and the poor get richer too. So there's this pessimistic narrative built up on nothing at all, just on these beliefs that inequality is spiraling out of control. Everybody's working harder and harder for less and less. And it's just simply not true. Not on no level is it true.
Now, there's also, on the other hand, I could say that maybe in some cases, it's their preferences. I mean, as you say, it doesn't really matter what people want to do if it's their own choice. And obviously, if people wanted to have the standard of living that people had had in, say, 1825, they could have that very easily. They could work very few hours, and they would have all the leisure in the world, and it would satisfy, every Henry David Thoreau in the world. You know, they'd have all the leisure time in the world that they want. But they don't want that. They'd rather work more hours because they'd rather have a higher standard of living in the leisure time that's still available to them.
Yeah.
So I could have that standard of living anytime I want.
You could. You could certainly have a 1930s standard of living. And it was in the 1930s that John Maynard Keynes wrote a famous essay about how within 100 years of him writing, we would be working a 15-hour week, because people have got a bit of a preference to doing a little bit of work now and again, but nobody could reasonably want to work more than 15 hours. And every now and again, you hear somebody he's saying, well, mate, Kane said this all these years ago and it still hasn't happened. If anything, we're working longer and all this kind of stuff. But of course, what Kane just didn't know and couldn't have known is that there's so many more things to spend your money on. We could have a 1930s standard living, which is to say maybe no running water, no telephone, no television, no internet and all this kind of stuff. You could have that working part-time now, very easy, very comfortably. I mean, you could have it probably without working at all on benefits, but people aspire to a lot more than that, and quite understandably so. And actually, a lot of people enjoy their work. That's the other thing. But at any given time, there's a trade-off between leisure time and work. A lot of people do say that they wish they could spend more time with their friends and family and so on, but their revealed preferences don't back that up. There's always, in every Western economy, a fairly large bank of people who are working part-time who want to work full-time. There's relatively few full-time workers who want to work part-time.
How about the old rich get richer and the poor get poorer thing? Now, there are certain underhanded ways that the rich get richer that everybody deplores. But if the poor, you know, you were saying this a minute ago about the poor allegedly getting poorer. If the poor were consistently getting poorer, once they hit subsistence level, that problem wouldn't persist. I mean, you can only get poorer consistently for so long. So there's got to be something wrong with that statistic. And there are people who say, but if you look at figures pertaining to wages and incomes, they've been stagnant or this or that. Maybe they have, but I'll tell you, I can't think of that many Americans who, given the choice between living in 2016 and living in 1976, with all the qualitative reductions in their standard of living that would be involved, with entire professions that a lot of people do these days not even being available, nobody in his right mind would take that option.
Yeah, and there's improvements in standard of living which are not caught in inflation-adjusted incomes. I mean, nobody is getting poorer anyway, as a group. But if you look at something like a family car, a family car today is just head and shoulders above a family car in the 1950s and 1960s, even though you might use a family car as being one component of a household's living standards. Yeah, I know there's probably the picture is not as rosy perhaps in America in terms of the stagnation of incomes, but I don't think anyone's arguing they're actually going down. And in Britain, most countries, they've certainly been going up across every income quintile for a very long time. And one of my favorite writers, Jean-Francois Revel, said in, I think, his last book, Last Exit to Utopia, he points out that people have been saying the poor are getting poorer since the days of Karl Marx. And if you consider the wretched conditions of the poor in the 1850s, then the poor must really be in a bad way now if this were true. And of course, it's not true.
I am so glad I have not heard that name Jean-Francois Revel in so long. I read him back when I was in college as a guilty pleasure when my professors weren't looking.
Yeah, The Totalitarian Temptation.
Yeah, what a extraordinary. I totally forgot about him. I'm so glad you mentioned his name.
If you haven't read Last Exit to Utopia, you really must. It's fantastic.
I will do that. I will do that. How long ago did he die?
Getting on for 10 years ago now.
Okay, so I hope you're not going to say he's still alive. Then I'd feel bad for asking that kind of question. How about this chapter you have on consumption? I mean, you have a chapter on the alleged paradox of prosperity. And part of that has to do with this so-called happiness research, and I've talked about that a little bit. I did an episode on whether you can really use so-called happiness research to prove that Denmark is the happiest country because they have a welfare state, and I brought a Danish professor on who knows the happiness literature inside and out, and he says that's just totally stupid. So I'll link to that on our show notes page for today, but tell me about the stuff in there.
Well, it's part of a running theme that we're getting to here, isn't it? About, we shouldn't work for any more economic growth. Economic growth doesn't matter. We should only focus on inequality. It's all about knocking economic growth and by association, knocking capitalism, which is really the only realistic engine of economic growth. So the paradox of prosperity is more or less based on Richard Easterlin's famous 1974 paper, in which he showed that happiness had not been rising since the Second World War, when records began for happiness, and yet economic growth had been rising, and he suggested that this, or it has been suggested on his behalf, that this showed that economic growth does not make people happy. But there's a basic problem with this, which Easterlin actually pointed out at the time, which is that people's aspirations change, the horizons get bigger as people get wealthier. And while economic growth can theoretically keep going and going and going, potentially indefinitely, if you're scoring happiness from 1 to 10, it's a bounded measure. You obviously can't go above 10. And realistically, people are very rarely going to say they're a 10 out of 10. It gives them nowhere to go, makes them sound slightly smug. And in fact, if you ask people in any reasonably wealthy society how they score themselves on life satisfaction or happiness, they'll generally say 6, 7, or 8. And so what you get in most countries is kind of a 7.2 or a 7.3, and it changes very little over time or between countries. And it doesn't tell you anything about economic growth. You might as well just say that inequality doesn't have an effect on happiness, because inequality goes up and down and happiness stays flat. You might as well say unemployment or war or economic catastrophe, anything, you know, nothing that's happened since the Second World War seems to have affected happiness, if that's how you're going to measure it. It's a dumb correlation to try and make.
I assume, given the small numbers, compared to the US anyway, of libertarians in the UK, there must be some attempt to try to account for this. Now, on the other hand, maybe what really needs to be accounted for is why there are so many in the US, not so few elsewhere, because there are even fewer in Australia. There are very few really anywhere. But given the historical kinship of the, you know, as Churchill said, the English-speaking peoples, it is, at least it invites investigation why it should be that there would be more here and fewer there. Have you guys tried to wrestle with that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we have a kind of a British liberal tradition that hasn't completely disappeared, but it's never really been called libertarianism. And, you know, we had Margaret Thatcher, who was kind of an economic liberal, and we've had other people along the way, even Tony.
Yeah, see, that's what I was thinking. That you know, we had Ronald Reagan, and who's sort of an analog to Thatcher, and we have politicians to this day who point to Reagan, and conservatives who point to Reagan and view him as their inspiration. And yet, with Thatcher, I don't feel like I see as much of that in the UK.
Yeah, you don't. It's you know, the art of politics is compromise, and I think there still is an innate belief in what you might describe, you know, John Stuart Mill's harm principle, that kind of thing. I think there's still a good remnant of that belief that the state should basically leave you alone unless you're damaging other people. But it is being eroded over time, particularly actually with some of this public health stuff where people's private lives have been explicitly micromanaged, usually on the basis that we all pay into the healthcare system and therefore we owe it to each other to be in pristine health. But the British economy is more liberal than most of mainland Europe. I know that's not saying a great deal. But we've never had a very strong, you know, Communist Party, for example, or even a very far left-wing Labour Party. We've got a left-wing Labour Party now, and they're doing appallingly in the opinion polls. So we kind of muddle along, forging a middle path without going to either extreme.
You are with the Institute of Economic Affairs, which is a shining beacon of hope, let's say, over there. I had the good fortune of having I wrote a book chapter for a book published by the IEA on the subject of Catholic social teaching. I wrote a chapter on the living wage, I think it was the just wage.
I wrote
a chapter on that. So I've followed you guys closely and been happy about what you've been doing. And I just recently had a person on the show, Nima Sanandaji, who wrote a book on Scandinavia that started off as a paper for you folks.
So yeah, he also wrote a piece about the spirit level, actually, around the same time I did.
Oh, okay, good. All right, so take just a minute, tell people about the Institute of Economic Affairs and then how they can find it.
Well, the Institute of Economic Affairs is Britain's oldest and some would say best think tank, founded in 1955. When the cause of economic liberalism seemed completely lost, and we struggled on for 20, 25 years until Margaret Thatcher took an interest in what we were saying, and she applied some of our ideas when she was liberalizing the economy in the 1980s, and we're still here trying to have an influence as being the free market voice, really, in Britain.
And what's the website?
The website is www.iea.org.uk, and we're based right in the middle of Westminster, just around the corner from the House of Commons.
Oh, very nice. All right. Well, I will link to it at tomwoods.com/771, show notes page for today. Do you in particular have any site or any blog or anything you'd like me to link to with your work in particular?
I blog personally at Velvet Glove Iron Fist, which you can easily find on Google if you type that in. That's usually about lifestyle economics and nanny state stuff. You can download any number of my publications, most of which are about the same subject, but the book we've been talking about today is called Selfishness, Greed, and Capitalism. You can buy that if you like on Amazon, but you can also download it for free from the IEA website. Again, if you Google my name, Christopher Snowden, and Selfishness, Greed, and Capitalism, that will come straight up.
All right, very good. And it's Snowden, S-N-O-W-D-O-N. So everybody,
D-O-N,
don't,
yeah,
yeah, don't assume Edwards. It's Edward Snowden. It's different. It's a different spelling. All right, well, it's fun talking. I'll definitely make sure and post all this at the show notes page so people get a chance to check out your work for themselves. Thanks for your time and keep fighting the good fight.
Pleasure. Likewise.
All right, that'll do it. Remember, I have yet another free ebook. I have got to stop myself one of these days. But for those of you who've been asking for something like a guide to podcasting or a guide to self-publishing a book and stuff like that, it really is a step-by-step overview. And then for those of you who might actually want to monetize some of those things, well, I've got plenty in there about that as well. Whether it's blogging or affiliate marketing, all these sorts of things, step-by-step instructions. But especially for you budding podcasters, if you want to know what equipment do you need, whatever, all of that is in great detail. I just actually reread it the other day and I said, this actually is a pretty good book. I should be charging for this thing, but you know, I'm too much of a softie, so I'm giving the thing away. You can check that baby out at PathsToIncome.com because it's called Five Paths to an Online Income. So it's PathsToIncome.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.